Welcome, one and all, to episode 6 of Life Without Consequence. 6 episodes. We're really getting into this. My name is Davey Francis. I wrote this book, I read this book, and I put this podcast out. I don't know if trigger warning is the right word I want to use here, but I do want to point out up top that these next few chapters are not easy. They weren't fun to write. They definitely weren't fun to read. I think if you pay close attention, you can hear that in my voice at certain points here. This is the section of the book that hammers home the irony of the novel's title. Life without consequence is not possible. Every action has a reaction. And this is where we see the reaction to what Parker and Benj have done. To recap, our protagonists have found themselves backed into a corner in possession of an absurd amount of stolen pharmaceuticals, with a dire need to get rid of it as soon as possible. Unwilling to let the merchandise go without gaining some sort of profit, they organized the world's most half-baked drug deal that went south when Benj was struck with a sudden bout of paranoia. It seems like every time they solve a problem, a new one presents itself. Parker and Benj are running out of ideas, and facing the music might turn out their only option. Before we get back into the story, I just want to thank my Patreon subscribers, particularly Hampus and Andrew McGuire. Thank you so much for your support. Welcome back to Life Without Consequence. Chapter 18, Nina. There had been a long and particularly awkward silence that followed Nina's explanation of how her boyfriend, the man they'd just caught in the act of looting a pharmacy, had somehow evaded arrest. She'd cried almost the entire time, which was something she'd never done in front of Logue before. Nina was confused, angry, upset, but all the while earnest in her recounting of what she'd seen while she was alone with Parker. He didn't believe her. She could tell. Who could blame him? It sounded like something from a bad science fiction novel. Logue was not a man who knew what to do around a woman in distress. Just last year, she'd watched him open-hand slap a woman as a means of calming her down. They'd been responding to a domestic disturbance in which a woman's husband had attempted setting her on fire. Her hysteria was an appropriate response. Nina hadn't reported it at the time. She didn't see the point, given that the detective already had an internal affairs folder thicker than most English language translations of the Bible. And as Logue had reminded her countless times, cops look out for other cops. Now Nina was the hysterical woman, and Logue probably would have slapped her into silence as well if he didn't have quite so much respect for her. Instead, he sat quietly in the police cruiser with her, staring off into space and probably hoping for a natural disaster to occur. Anything to avoid telling her how stupid the whole thing sounded. The sound of her own voice saying the words looped over and over in her mind, sounding more and more ridiculous with each repetition. He just disappeared. It's what happened. "Did you, get my cuffs back?" he asked, finally breaking the silence. Nina squinted, slowly craning her neck towards him. "Logue, he disappeared. At what point did you think I had the foresight to retrieve your..." She trailed off, realizing what he was getting at. "You think I let him go, don't you?" Logue's head bobbed back and forth as he chewed on his words. "I was only asking. It doesn't matter what I think. What matters is that I just called in an arrest we don't have. And the only explanation you have as to how the collar got away is that he disappeared into thin air." Logue gave Nina a chance to process it, a chance to experience how it sounded coming from another person. Nina scowled in reply. "You want to look guilty in the eye and tell him any of that?" Logue raised his eyebrows in a high arch and clicked his tongue. Nina rummaged through her thoughts for an idea, and to her surprise, came up with something relatively quickly. "Punch me in the mouth," she said, with an alarming amount of conviction. Logue stared at her quizzically and shook his head slowly. Seriously, split my lip open. We can say he overpowered me. The excitement in Nina's voice grew as she began to flesh out the idea. He overpowered me, and we didn't pursue because you were making sure I wasn't hurt. Ramirez, no one's gonna believe your boyfriend roughed you up. He's street trash, but everybody knows he wouldn't lay a hand on you. Nina rolled her eyes. They don't know it was Parker, Logue. Her partner winced as she said it. Nina rolled her lips inwards and let out a long and dissatisfied breath through her nose. Logue, please tell me you didn't just get on the radio and broadcast to every listening ear with a police scanner that you had my boyfriend down here in handcuffs. It annoyed her that she hadn't said ex-boyfriend, but it wasn't the time to split hairs. Logue just bounced his knee, pinching his plump lower lip between his thumb and forefinger. Logue, she pressed. I was excited! He tossed his hands up in defeat. The guy's trash, Ramirez. I've always known he was bad news. Not a single person at the station liked him, and... Shut up! Shut up! Shut up! She yelled over him. Nina scrunched her eyes closed and tried to think. This was a less than desirable situation to be in, and as far as she was concerned, it was all Parker's fault. Nina thought about how relieved she'd been when she saw him in handcuffs. For so long, instead of ripping off the band-aid, she'd been looking for excuses. For a moment, it seemed like he'd done all the hard work for her. And then he went and spoiled it, making her look like a crazy person in the process. There was no way she was going to let him get away with it. That's when Nina decided to stop thinking and start acting. Get out, she said. Logue looked at her, confused. What do you mean, get out? I mean, get out of the car, Logue. There are units en route. Buy me some time. I'm going to get him. Go and get him? He asked. Ramirez, you said he evaporated. That wasn't what she'd said at all, but Nina didn't see the point in correcting him. I know what I said, but if Parker's anywhere, I know where he'll be. It was like all of the confidence Nina had been robbed of back in the pharmacy had suddenly been replenished. Get out, she said, nodding towards the door. You better know what you're doing here, Nina, or we're both fucked, Logue warned. She met his eyes with a smile, and that was apparently all Logue needed to wave away his concerns. Logue stepped out of the car, and Nina scooted over the center console into the driver's seat. Without a second of hesitation, Nina started the car and left the parking garage. The tires squealed as she pulled off of the ramp and onto the surface streets, in the direction of Las Vegas. Chapter 19, Parker and Bench. There was an imminent police presence looming over them, and, if anything, their situation had only gotten worse. Not only did they still have a kitchen full of stolen pharmaceuticals, but now they'd managed to lose the only person they knew who could help them get rid of it all. The seconds ticked away, but for some reason, Parker and Benj were both relatively calm. Where is Tharsis, anyway? Parker mused as he tossed an empty pill bottle back from hand to hand. The mysterious destination of Tharsis was where Benj had sent Lenny to. It sounded familiar, but neither of them could place exactly where it was. It sounds like it might be Australian, he decided. He should be thanking us if you sent him there. I mean, he's probably locked inside of a shipping container, but at least their economy isn't in the toilet. Am I right? He waited for a response from Benj, but unsurprisingly received silence. Benj was laying flat out on the kitchen floor, making dust angels on the linoleum. He had no idea where Tharsis was. He'd just selected a random place as soon as he felt like the meeting was going south, and tapped the screen without giving it too much thought. Parker was sat in the sink, legs dangling over the side with his head leaned against the windowsill directly behind it. While his hands were busy with the pill bottle, Parker's eyes were occupied, following a long dead hanging plant that swayed gently from side to side above him. They hadn't done very much since teleporting Lenny away. Bring him back. I'm sure we could work everything out, Parker said with a surprising amount of confidence. He pushed himself up onto his elbows to look at Benj, who he saw making finger guns and shooting an angry stare at him in reply. He hadn't wavered on his assumption that Lenny had been armed. I'm telling you, he did not have a gun. Benj nodded in protest, slapping the ground for more emphasis. It didn't matter whether he did or he didn't. At this point, it was done. It had happened, and the only two options they had now was to either bring him back or leave him wherever he was. "He is probably losing his shit," Parker suggested with a chuckle. He wished he didn't find it quite so funny, but imagining Lenny frantically trying to make sense of what just happened to him did bring a smile to his face. The guy just made it so easy to dislike him. "Okay," Parker began. "Let's say he does have a gun. I can't imagine that he'll be too happy to see us. What if we do bring him back and he starts shooting?" Benj pulled himself to his feet and started to pace. The suggestion of a mental exercise seemed to bring him back to life a little. Parker set his pill bottle down and hopped up out of the sink to join Benj on his feet. "Yeah, that's the spirit. Get those brain legs moving," he said encouragingly. After just a couple moments of pondering, Benj snapped his fingers and waved for Parker to follow him through the door that led through to the dining room. Once Parker had joined him, Benj gestured for him to stand on the opposite side of the doorway and then pulled out the device. Before Parker had a chance to process that his quiet friend's plan was simply to just hide behind the door, Benj had pointed the phone into the kitchen and tapped the button. There had never been any indication that you needed to point the device at anything. For all Parker and Benj knew, they could have stood out on the porch and pressed the button, which would have been far safer. Learned behavior being what it was, Benj thought of the thing as a remote and considered danger just something you have to take in stride. "Really?" Parker mouthed to him as he glared with chastising eyes. The two friends stood quietly, waiting for something dramatic to happen. But all they heard from the kitchen was the sound of slow, labored breathing. "Hey, Lenny, buddy," Parker called into the kitchen. "Look, I know you're probably not too thrilled with us right now, and who could blame you? I'd be furious too. Benj here was just under the impression that you might have had a gun and wanted to look out for me." As he spoke, he slowly stepped one leg into the doorway. When nothing happened, he cautiously began to move the rest of his body out from cover. On the off chance that Benj had been right about the gun, Parker kept his hands up and his head down. He wanted to seem as non-threatening as possible. "What I want you to know is that the police are probably on their way here. So if you have a grudge you want to settle with us, is there any possible way you could save it until we've all avoided arrest?" Parker, now a whole two steps into the kitchen, continued to stare down at the fading pattern on the linoleum, waiting for a response. But all he heard was the same slow breathing he'd heard from the dining room. Gradually, Parker raised his eyes until he was able to see in its entirety the horrifying reality of what they'd brought back to their home. "Oh my God," he said through a whisper. It was Lenny, but it looked as though he'd been beaten nearly to death. There was duct tape covering his mouth, and his wrists had been bound. His face was purple from bruises that were so swollen they completely obscured his left eye. His arms hung at impossible angles, caused by two clearly dislocated shoulders. He was barely recognizable. Lenny was no longer wearing the oversized Rasta hoodie that he'd walked in with. Now the only thing covering his chest were more bloody strips of duct tape that ran from the center of his ribcage to just below his navel. Blood could be seen oozing out from either side of the tape, as if it had been used to close a wound. Parker stared at him, petrified in terror, until he was startled by the click-clacking sound of Benj dropping the teleporting device behind him. He turned to see Benj covering his mouth in shock. Then Lenny made a noise. Muffled by the tape, it was an awful, chesty, groaning sound that forced a bloody snot bubble out from his left nostril. Parker could see Lenny's single visible eye wince. Unable to tell if he was trying to communicate or simply crying out in pain. Anyone would be forgiven for assuming the latter, given his condition. The former was proven true, though, as Parker took small steps towards Lenny, which seemingly provoked him to let out another pained groan. He looked like he was trying to shake his head. And that's when the beeping started. It sounded like a digital alarm clock, ringing in some other room of the house. The kind of sound that reminds you to get up for work or rescues you from nightmares. This nightmare was real, though, and the beeping was coming from inside Lenny's chest. Parker's head quickly spun to look at Benj, who was equally confused by the sudden and incongruent noise. The sound began to rise in frequency, getting faster and faster until it reached a silent crescendo. Then, with a wet popping sound, Lenny's upper half was liquefied into a fine red mist that covered Parker, bench, and everything else in the kitchen. It hung freely in the air momentarily to be inhaled or tasted. All that was left of Lenny were his legs, vaporized down to the middle of his thigh. Two stumps, briefly standing independently before giving in to gravity and toppling over. The only thing Parker could hear was the thunderous beating of his heart as he tried to wipe the blood from his eyes. Once he could see, Parker glanced around the macabre scene for the briefest of moments before marching, as calmly as he was able, to the door leading out into their backyard. Benj followed right behind him, and at almost the exact same moment the door closed behind them, the two men began violently throwing up.
"What the fuck just happened?"
Parker grunted, wiping his mouth.
"Did he just..."
He trailed off, struggling for words and the balance to keep his feet under him as he looked back at the house in horrific disbelief. Sheer net curtains hung inside of the kitchen door, covering 12 little panes of glass that made up its windows. They'd been soaked entirely in Lenny's blood, making it look as though there was a dark crimson light glowing within the kitchen. Parker Luderi had always been the kind of guy who got away with it. Whatever it happened to be, a fortuitous twist of fate always allowed him to somehow skirt the consequences. There was a running joke about a race of benevolent mole people living at the Earth's core moving giant magnets that somehow helped steer him out of harm's way. That's not to say that things always turned out great, but as far as Parker was concerned, it never wound up being quite as bad as it could be. Right now, though, it was as bad as it had ever been, and given the specifics of their situation, it only looked like it was about to get worse. It was a twisted and selfish thought, but as he stared at the house, Parker couldn't help envying Lenny. Sure, he was dead, but at least it couldn't get any worse for him. He thought about marching out to the front porch, to wait for Nina and Logue, for another set of handcuffs, and to spend the rest of his days in jail. Admitting defeat, however, wasn't really Parker's style. And even right there in the darkest of places, he thought that he could feel a particular group of subterranean rodent people pushing their magnets around. "Benj," he called calmly to his friend, who he'd never seen wear a look that was quite so hopeless. "I got an idea," he said. And then Parker tried to wink reassuringly, but found sticky, drying blood made that impossible. Instead, it just looked like a strange twitch, and the hopelessness on Benj's face somehow grew even more pronounced. Chapter 20. Nina. Nina pulled into the parking lot of Rusty's night bar and genuinely considered going inside for a drink. God knows, after the past 24 hours, she could have really used one. Something to take the edge off would have been helpful. Sadly, the only thing Rusty had on hand that was stronger than beer or wine had probably been made by Parker, and indulging in the catalyst for their rather abrupt separation felt more than slightly hypocritical. She hadn't parked at Rusty's with the intent of becoming a patron anyway. Nina was trying to preserve the element of surprise. She'd wanted to roll up to Parker's house, guns blazing, but had managed to calm down slightly during the drive and realized making a scene wouldn't get her anywhere. If he was paying any attention at all, he'd see her coming the moment she turned onto his block. So Nina had opted for walking through the old neighborhood. It was baffling to her how quickly everything had escalated. It seemed like just a couple days ago, the two of them had been laughing over drinks. Now she was about to trudge through this war zone of a residential community and drag Parker off to jail. She tried to push the thought out of her mind, but Nina couldn't stop imagining a scenario where she arrived and found him celebrating. Celebrating and not giving a single shit that he'd finally done the thing she had for so long been afraid of him doing. ruining her career. Nina got out and went to the trunk to retrieve a pair of sweatpants and a hoodie, something she could wear over the top of her work clothes. One of the perks of being a detective was that she didn't have to wear that awful uniform, but she still looked like a cop, and cops were not welcome in Las Vegas. It was a sentiment echoed by the graffiti repeatedly scrawled on the outer walls of the neighborhood that read, "All cops are bastards," in blood red paint. Nina shook her head at the tag as she walked past it. Underneath the words were a collection of hash marks that were widely known to count the number of cops killed within the slum. 28. Nina thought the number seemed low. There was a reason police left this place alone unless they were coming in like an army. The preferred party favors of Las Vegas locals tended to lean on the faster side of things, which made for an active community regardless of day or night. Speed was cheaper and much easier to homebrew, which meant everyone usually had a little more pep in their step. The last thing Nina wanted right now was to get stuck in a conversation, so she kept her eyes down and followed her feet through the familiar streets. She occupied herself by trying to figure out the trick Parker had used at the pharmacy to make it look like he disappeared. When it happened, she'd believed it entirely. It was so realistic. After talking with Logue, though, her grip on reality had been readjusted, and she remembered that people don't just disappear. She said it out loud to remind herself, just in case any doubt felt like creeping back in. It was the kind of trick someone could do with mirrors, she thought. Anything that purported itself as a hologram was, after all, just carefully positioned panes of glass that gave the impression of a three-dimensional object. But that couldn't have been it. Logue's boot had very clearly connected with Parker's face. Recalling the impact made her wince. Nina knew Logue hated Parker, but she'd assumed it was more of a brotherly thing, like he thought she was way too good for someone like Parker. Of course, he was right. But she never imagined it was to the point where he really wanted to hurt Parker. Nina didn't even want to hurt Parker. Now, she just wanted him to disappear. Nina rolled her eyes at the thought. Not like that, she muttered to herself as she rounded the final corner. Parker and Benj's house stood four lots down from her now. She could see Benj's truck parked outside. There was also a second car she didn't recognize, an SUV. It was nice, too nice for this part of town, and that made her suspicious. Nina could see a dim light coming through the busted blinds that perpetually hung crooked in the front windows. She knew the lights were set up with motion detectors, so while there was no sign of any people, she knew someone had to be inside. The blinds were part of a long list of broken things in their house that he and Benj outright refused to repair or replace. Their fridge was about as consistent as Seattle sunshine, but the hulking thing stayed right there in their kitchen, forever faulty and constantly threatening to spoil something you were waiting to enjoy. Parker had explained it all as a show of respect to Benj's late parents, who furnished the house when they were both children. Nina understood the sentiment, but broken things are broken things, regardless of sentimentality. As Nina lamented, it occurred to her that she was putting off approaching the house, just standing on the corner, making a mental list of things she didn't like about how Parker lived his life. Realizing how unproductive she was being, Nina took one deep breath, and then walked towards the twisted chicken wire fence surrounding their front yard. The fence itself hadn't always been quite so jerry-rigged. At one time, wooden beams had stretched between the brick pillars that stood around the perimeter. Initially, they'd been painted in alternating blue and white, which had suggested a vaguely patriotic motif against the red bricks that held them in place. Nina always thought it looked gaudy. The beams had for years gone unattended to, eventually succumbing to the desert heat, and one by one disintegrated under their own weight. The pillars themselves showed signs of age, steadily withering away with bricks falling out of the cement, like old rotten teeth. The fence's primary function was preventing animals from gaining access. Wild packs of dogs were becoming a more and more common sight in the city. It used to only be a problem for the neighborhoods on the outskirts. But food was becoming scarce, and the dogs were becoming more brazen. The fence came up to Nina's waist and was easily pushed down and stepped over to avoid dealing with the noisy front gate. Her heart started to race as soon as she had both feet down on the soft, sandy dirt of the front yard. That's when she drew her pistol. The weight of the weapon in her hand flipped a mental switch, reminding her that she was there to work. Nina quickly covered the distance to the front porch, up the three little steps, and then flattened herself against the house's plastic siding. As she contemplated her next move, the light escaping through the broken slats in the blinds blinked off, signaling a lack of movement from the front of the house. Peering into the darkness only revealed a dim glow coming from where Nina knew the kitchen to be. She considered that the window to apprehend Parker might be closing and, disregarding her usual sense of discretion, opened the front door and stepped inside the house. Two delicate steps into the living room triggered the light's motion detection, suddenly bringing the room to life. The light itself wasn't all that bright, but Nina had been outside for so long it shocked her nighttime eyes. Frozen in place, she gradually peeled her lids back until her eyes had adjusted to the brightness, and she could pan around the room freely. All complaints aside, she loved this house. Mr. and Mrs. Cave had been surrogate parents for a revolving door of latchkey kids that passed through the neighborhood. A family didn't end up in Las Vegas because they had it all together, and there was a regular supply of this and that to distract a person from their parental responsibilities. The Cave residence was like a wholesome oasis that a child could escape to. They weren't hoarders, per se. They were just eccentric in terms of collecting. Bench's father had amassed the most extensive collection of magazines Nina had ever seen. Print media had been dead for decades, and Mr. Cave had been an absolute fiend for anything he could get his hands on. Bench's father didn't care if it was comic books or car magazines. He wanted it for his library of periodicals. Mrs. Cave loved art of any kind and had covered the walls with paintings, photos, and etchings. Nina knew that art was subjective, but the array of pieces that hung on the walls of this house regularly brought into question Benji's mother's ability to tell good art from bad art. They were taken by a drunk driver entirely too soon, and despite being the sole owner of the residence, Benji hadn't changed a thing. As she took the details in through the sights of her pistol, it occurred to Nina that this would probably be the last time she'd ever stand in this living room. The feeling hung more weight onto an already heavy heart, but before romantic nostalgia could coax out a hit of judgment-clouding dopamine, Nina reminded herself why she was there. The muffled sounds of coughing and gagging caught her attention. She turned, setting her sights on the saloon doors that led to the kitchen, and then quickly moved across the room. Using the barrel of her gun, Nina pushed through the door. It squeaked with a familiar sound. As a child, she'd always thought it sounded like a worn-out animal toy. And suddenly, Nina found her mind making one last desperate attempt to inflict a pleasant memory upon her. It was as if part of her knew what was coming before she did. The smell hit her like a punch in the gut. The tangy, metallic aroma swam to her and announced itself to all of Nina's senses able to receive it. "I am blood," it said. "You know me well." And she did. Nina's job had led her to see things that should never have to be seen by human eyes. She had witnessed what the evil that nested inside of human beings was capable of, but it never got easier. Especially not when it was like this. "Oh, God," she said as the feeling of falling came over her. "Parker, what have you done?"
Life Without Consequence, Chapter 21. Parker and Benj. "I don't want to go back in either, Benj, but it's either this or jail. And how well do you think you'll do in there?"
Benj wanted nothing to do with going back inside of the house. It wasn't unreasonable given what was waiting for them on the other side of the door. But Parker was adamant that he could fix everything in less than a minute if they just went back inside. It wasn't so much of a plan as it was a theory, and a theory would have to do given their circumstances. Parker was hoping that trying to teleport one of the more substantial collections of Lenny's remains would trigger some sort of chain reaction and cause every part of him to teleport. In his mind, it was just like teleporting an average person. The only difference was that this person was very spread out. It was a Hail Mary, a last-ditch effort. It was a sketchy ladder thrown up against the inside of a pit that his actions had dug for them. It wasn't great, but it was all he could come up with, and he wasn't going down without exhausting every last one of his options. Parker couldn't believe how much effort it was taking him to avoid the phrase, "How much worse could it get?" If this day had proven anything to him, it was that it would always find new and inventive ways for things to get so much worse. Bench pointed at himself, then flicked both of his middle fingers off of his thumbs, finally pointing at Parker. There wasn't any malice to it. It was delivered with exhaustion, if anything. "Yeah, I hate me too," Parker said with conviction. "But I'm gonna hate me even more if you wind up having to suffer from my fuck-up." It was a rare moment of sincerity from Parker that Benj responded to with a stern glare. He corrected himself. "Suffer any more than you already have, I mean." The tension between the two men seemed to ease, and Benj reluctantly made his way towards Parker in the house. "It's just blood," he said, throwing an arm around Benj's shoulder. "I'm covered in it. You're covered in it. This is going to be a breeze." It was a pep talk that Parker lost all faith in the moment he was once again met with the reality of their kitchen. Every direction his eyes scanned was covered in the marbled patterns of coagulating blood. He'd never seen so many shades of red. From the ceiling to the floor, there wasn't a single surface that wasn't somehow blessed with a little piece of Lenny McAllister. The smell was almost unbearable, and Benj immediately tried to back away, rescinding his complacency with this madness. The grip Parker had on his shoulder tightened, ensuring forward momentum. "Let's just get this done, yeah?" Wanting to get it over and done with, Benj tried to rush inside, nearly losing his balance on the slick linoleum floor. The last thing either of them wanted to do was fall down. Regardless of how much of it they were already covered in, neither of them wanted any more blood on them. The device was right on the floor where he'd left it, but the layer of blood on everything made it tough to pick up. Benj had to use both hands to pry it up away from the linoleum. Slimy red tendrils hung from its edges as he lifted it away from the floor to examine it. The screen was covered in red smears, and now wore a small hairline crack in the top right-hand corner. It seemed functional, despite the touchscreen now being a little less responsive. "All good?" Parker asked, watching intently. Benj pushed his lower lip out and nodded speculatively. It didn't seem like an actual confirmation of anything, more just a response for the sake of doing something. Benj opened the app, which was still set to the front-facing camera, and saw his blood-splattered face fill the screen in high definition. He grimaced at just how disturbing his appearance was. Silently cursing Parker, he flipped the screen to the primary camera and went through the motions of selecting Lenny's legs as the object to teleport. The focus on the device no longer moved quite as smoothly. Before the drop and the blood, the bright neon outlines hopped fluidly from one object to another. Now they stuttered and glitched across the screen, struggling to stay in one place. He tried to wipe the lens off on his clothes, but it only seemed to worsen the problem. The longer it took, the faster Benj felt his heartbeat. Parker kept his eyes down as Benj worked. There wasn't an ideal place to look, and he felt like closing his eyes would have been unfair to his friend, who he'd convinced to go back inside. Parker stared at the footprints they'd left and tried not to think about how much time was passing. The longer he stared at them, though, the more he felt they looked strange. By the time he figured out why, it was too late, and he heard Nina's voice making demands. "Parker, put your hands behind your head," she said. With her gun raised and aimed right at him, Nina slowly edged into the kitchen. He stared at her as she took small, controlled steps towards him. She moved with precision, one foot allowing the other to catch up before making another move forward. He observed her eyes as they darted back and forth between him and Benj, never letting either of them out of her sight for more than a couple of seconds. This was practiced behavior, trained and drilled. "Benj, stop whatever it is you're doing and put your hands on your head too." He looked to Parker as if he was asking for permission. "Don't look at him. Look at me. Put your hands on your head," she said. She wasn't yelling or barking commands at either of them. Her words were as controlled as the small steps she continued to take towards Parker. "Nina, what are you doing?" Parker said calmly, mimicking her cadence. He tried to take a step backwards and somehow prolong the distance between them, but she caught him the moment his foot left the ground. "Don't! Move, she said, raising her voice slightly. Don't move. Don't speak. I don't want to hear the sound of your voice. There was something so strange about the way that she spoke to him. Sure, she was angry, but that wasn't all there was to it. It had been on the tip of his tongue, and he felt so stupid when it clicked. All it took was a momentary glance at their surroundings to realize that her voice was filled with fear. Nina, we didn't do this, he said, quickly rushing out his words. Shut up, she screamed. Shut up! Nina's slight momentary loss of control was apparently all the time Benj needed to finish. He tapped the bloody tip of his thumb against the screen, but instead of watching a million and one pieces of Lenny vanish before his eyes, he felt the familiar shiver of teleportation passing over him and heard what sounded like thunder clapping in the next room. The lights flickered and the ground shook, filling him with a deep dread before returning to normal. Something had happened. While nothing had visibly changed, Parker, Benj, and Nina were all still standing in the same kitchen, still painted wall to wall with the remains of a local drug dealer. Parker's plan hadn't worked. Nina stumbled towards Parker, experiencing the sensation of her atoms reassembling for the first time. Her gun waved haphazardly in a loose grip as she tried to steady herself. Parker attempted to help her find balance, but Nina responded by violently shaking him away. He jumped back, standing with Benj on the other side of the table now, cautiously looking at her as she raised her eyes to look at them. What did you do? Nina mumbled. Parker didn't say anything. Before he could even begin to form a collection of words that might have satisfied that question, there was a loud cracking sound that came from outside, startling all three of them. Parker and Benj shared a bewildered glance as Nina retrained her pistol on them before loudly reiterating herself. What did you... Nina was interrupted by a sudden rumbling that preceded a giant fist exploding through the 12 tiny panes of glass behind her, engulfing her entire face and shooting tiny glass daggers towards Parker and Benj. It made the house look like it was built out of papier-mâché, easily breaking through not only the windows, but the entire frame that held the door in place. Nina! Parker screamed. He could see the muscles on the forearm attached to the hand flexing as five giant fingers squeezed Nina's skull. Each one of the four fingers wore tarnished brass rings that sat below knuckles scarred so deeply he could see the bone, kicking her legs and grasping at the massive hand, but it was no use. Then, as easily as it had smashed through the wall, it ripped Nina back out through the ragged hole it had made, lifting her body like a rag doll. Immediately, Parker took off to chase after her and whatever it was that had just taken her. But Benj grabbed his arm, holding him back. What the fuck are you doing? He protested, but Benj didn't let go. Parker looked at the gaping hole where the door had been and suddenly realized what had happened. His plan had worked, but maybe too well. Outside of the door, where he would have usually seen the starless lavender sky of downtown Las Vegas, Parker could see an endless ocean of stars. They had teleported the entire house. To where, though? And what was that thing outside? Nina! He screamed again, but his voice was drowned out by another clap of thunder. With it came howling gusts of wind that carried debris from the ragged hole in their wall. Chunks of drywall went airborne along with splinters of glass, ripping open the bags from the pharmacy that created a whirlwind of medical supplies. Somehow, through the cacophony of this living nightmare, Parker heard her scream. He would have known her voice amongst millions. He looked at Benj as tears began to stream down his face. Then, as the despair of hopelessness took him entirely, he dropped to the floor, holding his face in his hands. There wasn't a single thing he could do except wait for whatever had taken her to come for him too. Benj felt the tingle of electricity flowing from the device into his hand. He let go of Parker and stared at the screen with wide-eyed panic. It flickered on and off, each time returning with a more glitchy and distorted version of the home screen, until it eventually went blank. Parker began crawling towards the door, shielding his eyes from what was now a raging storm and screaming Nina's name. Benj pounded the device against the palm of his hand, begging anyone who might be able to help for it to just turn back on. All he needed to do was tap the button once and he could send them home. A few seconds felt like an eternity before the screen illuminated once again with the ominous symbol of Itinerant Solutions. The snake devouring its own tail. The offensive infinity of it all. By the time Benj saw the home screen, Parker had made it all the way to the hole in the wall that led outside. He was on his knees, holding himself up with the remains of the doorframe and shrieking obscenities into the wind. Benj bolted across the room and grabbed him by the collar of his jacket, dragging him back away from the chaos he seemed moments away from walking out into. His fingers clasped around his friend's shoulder. Parker spun to meet his eyes and regarded him with an expression of abject terror. Ben shook the device, hoping Parker would know what he meant. He did, and he didn't like it. "We can't leave her!" Parker yelled, but it was already done. Parker heard the dull, tinny sound of his voice reverberate around the inside of a metal shipping container and began to realize where he was. He saw the letters CLE-OH spray-painted on the wall beside a dim construction lamp. No, 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 no. Benj looked on from the corner of the container, watching his friend, his only friend, experience a feeling he was quite familiar with. No, 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 no. Parker tried to hold it, to push it down inside of him, as if keeping it all inside would stop it all from being real. No, 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 no! He mumbled the words until he was screaming them. With tears blurring his vision, Parker threw himself at the door, screaming wildly as he punched and kicked at the blocked exit. The screams came from deep inside of him, from a memory before people were people and they were just animals. He kept on until the surge of adrenaline exhausted, and the only changes to the door were bloody smears left from his knuckles. Parker slowly turned his attention back to Benj. There was an emptiness to his expression. "Send me back," he said between deep, gasping breaths. Benj was frozen. He'd never seen that kind of rage come out of Parker before. "Send me back there!" Parker screamed, rushing Benj and pinning him against the wall by his shirt. Parker's teary eyes glimmered in the dim yellow light as Benj shook his head, holding the device up for him to see. Wherever Tharsis was, they couldn't go back there. They couldn't even go home. The device was dead. Life Without Consequence. Interlude. Bael, 2015. Bael hated planet Earth in ways he was unable to fully articulate. He hated the air, the plants. He hated the length of the days and the horrible face they made him wear. He hated the way the sunlight diffused through the moisture in the atmosphere at certain times of day. Once, there was a time where he could have told you, almost to the second, exactly how long he'd been left to endure this world and its many, many unpleasantries. Now all he could do was tell you that it had been a very long time. Somehow in all the days, weeks, months, all the trips around the sun this vile little rock made, Bael only managed to find two things he was able to derive any joy from. The first was the bitter and violent cold of a Midwestern winter. The only thing there that bore the slightest resemblance to his home. He'd begged to be placed somewhere with even more aggressive temperatures, somewhere in Russia or northern Canada. But the scales had spoken that he would spend his days in Cleveland, Ohio, of all places. And the scales were the law. The second thing he enjoyed was the people, most specifically their fear. Human beings were such fragile things, a sentiment not lost on them. The people of Earth possessed an acute awareness of their rather tenuous grip on this mortal coil, something that provided a base for the kind of terror Bael lived for. Other worlds existed that could offer Bael many of the creature comforts Earth denied him. But unfortunately, they were all places that had been given a glimpse behind the curtain. Places aware of the horrors that kept the wheels of infinity in motion. places that knew of things far more terrifying than a creature like Bael. He reminded himself of this while he suffered through the long gaps between assignments. Earth was torture, but the cosmic balancing act all things must adhere to was made equal whenever Bael was allowed to indulge in the terror of this planet's inhabitants. While he'd never been placed on a world he was able to terrorize freely, without let or hindrance, he had never been shackled quite like he had been on Earth. This was the first time that the Heralds, the beings that interpreted the scales of infinity, had insisted he follow the rules. They had even gone so far as to insert him as an officer of the law to ensure he was on his best behavior. He was to blend in, to be one of them. He was to wait. But sometimes the waiting went on for so long, he began to wonder if they'd forgotten him entirely. Paranoia like that had been laid to rest tonight, though. Tonight, Bael's human mask smiled from ear to ear, for it was freezing cold, and there were humans he'd been asked to kill. Bael had been tasked with retrieving a stolen key from someone who was either very brave or very stupid. The keys were the tools of the beings he served, and while Bael himself was ignorant to the extent of their power, he knew they were capable of incredible feats that would be wasted on the simple whims of man. The thief had not acted alone, but in just a few short hours, Bael had dispatched all accomplices that may have provided them with aid. One by one, he pruned them from existence, gradually backing his target against a wall. Bael found that the people here were so susceptible to theatrics, and he'd enjoyed himself more and more as the night wore on, using each kill to enhance the next. He was having so much fun, he didn't mind that he'd completely ruined his human skin. Even the most resilient sung the chorus of truth Bael requested of them, but somehow the ringleader of this little band of heretics managed to evade his grasp, undoubtedly aided by the key. While his company's tools could be used against him, Bael was privy to something his target was not. The scales of infinity provided him with insight into actions his mark had not yet taken. While the insatiable serpent of infinity endlessly devours itself, its waste, what beings like Bael understand as existence, is rarely reproduced precisely in the same way twice. It may resemble what preceded it, and predictions can be made, but at its core, infinity is entropy. And the scrying of the scales will not always come to be accurate. Bael knew about the warehouse and its traps. He knew that a storm door on the exterior south-facing wall would lead down into a basement. He knew that pushing aside an old shelving unit would reveal a hidden room where he would find an old man wearing a dirty lab coat, the man he had been looking for. Imagine his surprise when all he found was a gravely wounded Cleveland police officer, trying with what little he had left in him to blindly crawl in the direction of the doorway that Bael now occupied. He was furious. Failure wasn't something he was used to, and he immediately began to ponder the possible penalties for tonight's lack of success. His fist swelled dramatically, shedding a layer of his human skin as he swung it at the wall, removing a chunk of plaster the size of a bowling ball and provoking a pathetic whimper from the cop. The noise was like nails on a chalkboard to Bael, who reflexively moved to end the man's life, only stopping upon the realization that the kill would have been a kindness. And kindness was not in Bael's nature. In hopes that this creature's suffering might act as a salve for the anger he felt, Bael crouched down to watch the last of its life painfully ebb away.
"It's easy to feel lied to," said the voice of someone who hadn't been there before.
The voice washed over Bael in a tidal wave of dread. His employers rarely appeared to him in person. More commonly, he received veiled communications, only coming as often as they needed to. This was the first time in years they had ever spoken to him directly. Hand throbbing at his side, Bael straightened himself and turned to face his visitor, bowing his head respectfully.
"The scales are but a labyrinth that changes as we attempt to solve it. We thought you'd be used to this by now," someone continued.
The comment confused him slightly. Thus far, the scales had never led Bael astray. The communiques he'd received that told of their interpretations had always been absolute,
This was the first time something he had been told to expect had not come to pass.
"The thief," Bael said, eyes still lowered. "They were supposed to be here."
Yes, someone said, briefly pausing as if to absently ponder an unrelated thought. "But they are not." They wore a long robe, so dark that it might have been constructed from black holes. It revealed only the alabaster disc of a face, possessed by someone who hadn't seen the light of this particular sun before. Their features did not provoke recognition, but that didn't mean that this was the first time Bael'd stood in this specific herald's presence. While he had expected harsh punishment, the being that hovered before him seemed almost disinterested in the events of the evening.
"Come,"
someone requested, and beckoned with the pale whisper of flesh that Bael understood as a hand. He felt a pull, a force being exerted upon him from the center of his mass, and in the amount of time he had to process the sensation, Bael found himself hovering just above the dusty basement floor, mere inches from his principal. A second appendage appeared from within someone's robe. 5 pale fingers clutched at something. It was a cell phone.
"A gift,"
the herald proclaimed pleasantly. But Bael was unsure if he had actually heard the words aloud, or just felt them inside of his mind. Still floating, Bael did his best not to balk at the item being offered to him as he reached into the back pocket of his bloodstained jeans and produced his own phone.
"I appreciate the offer," he said, "but I already have my own."
"Not like this one," someone said with a warm smile. Bael looked down at the device and saw its screen illuminate with a crude depiction of a serpent consuming its own tail. The Ouroboros, the effigy of infinity. It began as shock, but as the realization of what was being given to him grew clearer, Bael's expression quickly shifted.
"I've never..."
He stumbled over his words, unsure how to appropriately react.
"It's not what I expected."
"The keys look how they need to look," someone replied confidently, as Bael took the device. It felt as though he'd plucked something right out of thin air, as though it had no mass until his fingertips touched it.
"I can leave then?"
Bael asked of Earth, and the human shape he held. A key, the tool of the heralds, would allow Bael the freedom to travel wherever he wished in the blink of an eye, a prospect that provoked an even larger smile to grow across his face. A smile that was removed with surgical precision when someone responded to his question.
"Oh no,"
the herald clarified. This is where you are supposed to be. Bael tried to disguise the anger rising to a boil inside of him, but it was no use. Someone knew.
"Make yourself at home," it remarked flippantly. "Get a pet."
Bael examined the key, tilting it back and forth in his hands.
"What do you want me to do with it?"
he asked. Someone smiled, more deviously this time.
"Whatever you want.
That's what it's for." The herald paused, observing the curiosity it felt emanating from Bael.
"Keep it safe."
He thought about it momentarily. Bael hated the earth, but this gift would make things much more bearable. He raised his head to thank the herald, but Bael found that he was once again all alone, covered in blood, in the basement of an old abandoned warehouse. With a new lease on life, he turned back to the cop, who had begun convulsing near Bael's feet, and decided that maybe he did have a little kindness in him after all.
Thank you.
Artwork for Life Without Consequence was provided by Daniel Sewell. You can find him on Twitter at writerDanSewell. That's DanSoule. Music for this episode was provided by me, Davey Francis. You can find more of my music at DaveyFrancis.com.